This week on Pop of Culture, we've decided it's springtime.
We'll learn about bonsai, talk to the host of PBS's Life in Bloom, and see a series of ecosystem paintings that took 15 years to complete.
And I work from the actual plant. I don't use photographs. And there's nowhere you can go and just take a snapshot of what I've got and say that this is the ecosystem, because I go back constantly.
That's coming up in this encore edition of Pop of Culture.
Pop of Culture on IPR is made possible in part by Psi Iota Xi. Additional support comes from the Indiana Arts Commission, the Community Foundation of Randolph County, the National Endowment for the Arts, and sustaining members of IPR. You can support local programming today at indianapublicradio.org.
From IPR, this is Pop of Culture. I'm Kara Duquette.
And I'm Jen Blackmer. The Pop of Culture team is off this week, so while spring struggles to get here, we thought we'd listen back to some of our interviews about plants.
Back in January, we stepped into the warm greenhouse of Kat Dyack to learn about the art of bonsai.
Could you tell us what makes a plant a bonsai?
Bonsai, exactly translated, is planted pot. So one could argue that any plant is a bonsai. But if you want to be technical, bonsai is a plant that has been cared for, worked with, shaped, not just the branches, but as well as the roots, potted up into more of a ceramic pot, and lovingly cared for years on end. People can start bonsai and have them for a few years, and there are bonsai that have been handed down through family members because they're so old.
Wow. So is there an average lifespan of a bonsai?
I wouldn't say there's an average lifespan. I would probably say that based on the life of the trees and the life of the care, that most bonsais are going to easily live for 50 to 100 years.
Well, we are surrounded here by beautiful plants in Kat's greenhouse, and I see a large grouping of bonsai, and I was wondering if you could like pick one of your favorites and kind of talk about it specifically and describe it for our audience.
Oh, that's easy. my favorite bonsai is ficus. And ficus is more of a non-traditional style of bonsai. Original bonsai were made more from conifers, so things like junipers, spruce, those styles of plants. But ficus, for me, especially as a novice, even though I've been working with bonsai for about 4 to 5 years now, is a very forgiving plant, and it's a very fast-growing plant. So you have more of an opportunity to work with it. If you want more of that great interaction with your plant, you want to be able to do more with your plant, repot your plant more often, then the ficus is just the way to go.
Well, okay, so there's this ficus that I'm looking at right now, and it's like, it looks like a tree outside. That's what I love about bonsai. It looks like this tiny little tree you would see outside, and you're talking about how it grows fast, the ficus in particular. Mm-hmm. How do you keep it so small?
So it's all about pruning your plants. And bonsai, to me, is one step above horticulture. So in horticulture, you're pruning your plant back and you are still doing some shaping. But with bonsai, part of the point is to make your tree look like a miniature tree. You want to mimic what the tree looks like in nature by pruning it in different directions, by feeding it, by giving it the appropriate light. And as your tree grows and even the wire wrapping, you can shape it in order to make it look like a tree that you would find in nature.
Well, so how did you get into making bonsai, or what would you say the term is?
I would say working with bonsai.
Okay.
Because I do think it's a collaboration between you and the plant.
I love that.
It takes a lot of patience, and the plant doesn't always want to do what you want it to do. So you have to kind of work with the plant and decide, well, you know, it wants to grow in one direction, so we'll kind of take it there, but I'm going to play with it a little bit and turn it and shape it. I started with bonsai. It was right after COVID, and I was recently let go from my job. They eliminated my position at the company that I was working with, and I needed to find a new direction. And I started working with plants, and it had been a few years, and I was doing a lot of research, and I was trying to find out what plants I wanted to work with. And of course, as you're scrolling through YouTube, there's just videos popping up everywhere, and I found this crazy guy from Canada. His name is Nigel Saunders, and he has a YouTube channel called The Bonsai Zone. And he just clicked with me. And he also has a love of ficus, so that helped. And I just watched him talk to his plants and prune his plants. And as he worked with them, I'm like, I can do that. Well, it's a lot harder than it looks. And so I decided, okay, well, I'll pick up some plants and I'll try my hand at it. And I killed each and every one of them.
Oh, no.
Yeah. And so I reevaluated what I was doing and realized that I still knew absolutely nothing about bonsai. And I went back and I watched some more videos and I'm like, well, let's try some house plants. And so that's when I started working with ficus and realizing that it was a whole lot easier and it was definitely much more up my alley. And so now my personal collection keeps growing and growing, much to my husband's dismay. And that's really kind of where it all started from. And as I grew my own collection, as I continued to sell plants, I thought that the bonsai was a great opportunity to really introduce Muncie and the surrounding areas to what bonsai is.
So when do you know it's time for your bonsai to leave the greenhouse and go into the community?
That's a tough question because in the end, I really want to keep all of them.
Fair enough.
But as I'm working with it, a lot of them start out in little nursery pots. Some are grown from seeds. A lot of them are cuttings from larger trees, which is much easier to get the thicker trunk. And I guess you get to the point where as you're working with bonsai and you're looking at them and appreciating them, you just almost get a feeling that, okay, I think you're ready.
So there's so many beautiful plants here that you have. Are there some other plants that you would like to discuss with us?
My other favorites are air plants. I added them to my nursery collection, it'll be about 2 years in April. And I started out with just a handful. I of course, look around, see what other people have. What are people carrying? I do research online to see what's popular. And I'm like, well, air plants could be kind of fun. I ordered some in, and I got a great response from people. And air plants are unique, as they don't require any soil at all. So air plants thrive on water and light. And because they don't require soil, there's so many great things that you can do with them. And it's amazing the different shapes and sizes that they come in. A lot of people don't realize that air plants aren't always these tiny little ones that we see at the grocery store or the hardware store, that they can actually grow up to several feet long or several feet high.
I did not know that. And there's no root system that need be in soil, but is there a root system?
Some of them do have root systems. A lot of the larger ones do. One of the largest air plants out there is called a xerographica. And in nature, they attach themselves to trees. So they do end up creating a root system. A lot of times they sit in the crook of the branch and the trunk, and they'll create a root system in order for them to hold in place. And then that way they get the dappled light under the tree, they get the rain as it comes down, and they'll also get some of the nutrients from the tree as the leaves fall and rot and turn into some compost. But a lot of the other air plants are sort of free-floating.
Lovely. Well, is there any other thing you'd like to talk to us about today?
If people are interested in getting into collecting, beautifying their space, enhancing their environment, reach out to your local nurseries, or reach out to me, Google, YouTube, and start with one variety. So many people jump in and they pick up like 10 plants. And then they all die because each one takes a different type of care. And as you learn, it's amazing to know that you're really not the one in charge. The plant is the one in charge because it's all about what they need. It's their light. It's how much water they need. But as I said before, as a collaboration, you need to know what's going to work in your environment.
Well, thank you so much for sharing with us today. And I also would like you to tell everybody where they could find you if they were interested in starting a plant journey.
You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Marketplace. I do appointments through my house. I also do the Delaware County Flea Market at the fairgrounds, which is the first Saturday of every month.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Kat.
Thank you.
We visited Kat Dyack's home greenhouse earlier this year. This is Pop of Culture. I'm Kara Duquette.
And I'm Jen Blackmer. This Saturday morning, April 19th, on Ball State PBS, you can catch an episode of Jay Schwanke's Life in Bloom, where he visits Minnetrista in Muncie.
We spoke to the PBS host late last year about how he got started in the flower trade.
And Jay, welcome to Pop of Culture.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here. So it's wonderful.
I'm excited to have a conversation with you, most certainly. And as the flower guy, obviously we're going to talk a lot about flowers, but because this is Pop of Culture, we're also going to be talking about your journey as an artist and how you came to do this thing that you do. And so I'm going to ask you first off about your journey as an artist, but I want to start with the fact that you were born at a flower convention. Is that true? And give us some details.
Absolutely. So yes, it's true. I think that I was born for this job. my mom and dad were the executive directors of the Nebraska Florist Society. And so that meant that they ran an association for about 400 florists in the state of Nebraska. My dad also ended up being the president of the Society of American Florists. And my mother was a professional floral communicator, and they traveled, and they're infamous in the flower industry. Right. And so they were running this grower school in March of 1960. And my mother suddenly turned to my dad and said, "We need to go somewhere to have this baby," because she was very pregnant. And she said, "My water just broke and I think it's time." And my dad said, "Have you looked outside? There was 19 inches of snow in Hastings, Nebraska that weekend." And he said, they've closed the roads. And they paged the front desk. There was a general practitioner there who delivered me in room 386 of the Hastings Hotel.
That is incredible. And there really was a doctor in the house, right? So that's like the cliche. Thank goodness, is there a doctor in the house?
A general practitioner who took care of it all. Yes. So,
did they put a flower in your fist or something, in your little baby fist? And
no, but I'm a fourth generation florist. My family, 1896, my great grandfather started our family business in Fremont, Nebraska. He purchased a bankrupt greenhouse that grew palms for people, this Victorian homes. And then it, over time, became a flower shop where we had 7 acres under glass where we raised the flowers that we cut and sold to the general public.
Oh, that's awesome. And so you really had no choice. I mean, fourth generation flower family. I mean, this was sort of your calling, right?
Well, I think it's very interesting when you say that, because so people refer to me as the flower expert. And That's sometimes confusing for people. I am not the garden expert. I'm not going to tell you where to garden and where to plant a hydrangea. I have no idea. But I can tell you about every type of cut flower that probably exists to man, and mm-hmm. how it responds being a cut flower, how long it will last arranging it, how to arrange it, those types of things. So I think that that's important. But here's the great story that goes with that. So when I was in high school, I was a junior, and I had an amazing, one of the people I still think so much of, and is still alive in Fremont, Nebraska. Her name is Jan Therian, and she was my guidance counselor. And she called me into her office and she said, you know, your parents say you have to go to college. You have to go to college. And we need to determine what you are going to do for a living, because that is what you should go to college for. And since your parents have this open invitation to go, you need to go. Mm-hmm. And she said, what do you think? And I said, and so my entire life, I love animals. I love flowers the most, but I love animals second. And I said, I would love to be a zookeeper. And she said, oh dear. She said, you know, you don't do well in math or science. You know, you're very good in art, but you know, though you're not highly skilled, and you're going to basically have to become a doctor. And this is going to take a lot of dedication and a lot of hard work. And you know, you're basically lazy. And I was like, yes, please tell me more. And she said, I said, what do you think I should do? And she said, you know, you already know more about flowers than anyone I know. And mm-hmm. you've grown up in it. I literally ran through the flowers in the greenhouse every single day of my life. That's what I did. And she said, you should become a florist, because it will be easy. You'll be good at it. And it will be wonderful. And I was like, okay, that's what we're going to do. And so it was interesting, because at that point in time, I had already started to work at the flower shop, and I was already involved in the flower business and the management of the people there. And I would go into work in the morning and get everybody set for their day. And then I would go to school, and then I would come back home. And it was just like, it was a very family oriented business. I worked with my mother, my father, my grandfather. There was, I think 13 at the most at one point in time, family members, and a lady wow. who worked for us for 90 years. So there was, it was crazy, you know, or 67 years. She was 90, but she worked for us for 67 years. But so I knew that that was what I wanted, you know, that was a good thing to do. And so I decided to go to the little parochial college in my hometown so that I could work and go to college at the same time.
And this was in Hastings, yes?
In Fremont, Nebraska.
Fremont,
Nebraska. Fremont, Nebraska, Lincoln, Nebraska, and Omaha form a triangle, mm-hmm. about 40 miles apart. And I graduated there with a degree in marketing and another degree in public relations, which has served me very well.
But I'll bet,
long for the ornamental horticulture piece. And so now, in Jan Therian's defense, I always want her to come on the show. I want her to come and tell the story and let me tell the story about her, because I think she's divine. And she's just like, I am not doing that.
It's funny. The mentors in our life are all oftentimes the ones that don't want the spotlight, even though they were so instrumental.
Yeah, I was just so thankful she was honest. Yeah. She cared about me, and she was like, you won't succeed at that. You're going to succeed at this. And I say to her, the proof of the pudding is, you know, that I have a national television show that's in, you know, 97% of the market in all 50 states, and people love Jay Schwanke's Life in Bloom. And
that's
so
right. We're getting ready to start season 7. Yes.
I did the right thing. Jan gave me the perfect advice. So yeah.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, that's great. So there's an art to flower arranging, obviously. I mean, things make us, we love to surround ourselves with things that are aesthetically pleasing. But I have this suspicion that you feel that flowers do more than that, right? What are some of the more perhaps unusual reasons that people may want to invite flowers into their lives?
So the whole basis of our show was to talk to people about the health and wellness benefits of flowers. I told you that my father was the president of the Society of American Florists. Mm-hmm. And when he was there, he established a foundation for floristry. Him and several other gentlemen got together, and they created the American Floral Endowment. And what that did for many years was fund research by Dr. Haviland Jones, who is still alive to this day. I believe she's 98 years old. She doesn't grant interviews anymore, but she did so much work at Rutgers University, at Boston University. And since then, many other people have jumped on the bandwagon, and they have done other research. But there's these amazing pieces of research that prove to us that, first of all, flowers make us have happier thoughts. Mm-hmm. They reduce our stress. They lower our blood pressure when we're in the presence of flowers. If we are sick and we receive flowers, we get better faster. So seniors who are surrounded or are in the presence of flowers will enlarge their circles of friends. They'll be more apt to seek medical attention for something that ails them. They will have less depressing thoughts and less despair. If there's flowers in your workplace, you're apt to be more creative. So these things start to happen. Now, the interesting thing about that is it happens with being in the presence of flowers, but it also happens with being in the presence of flower images mm-hmm. or in the presence of plants. These things all work together. I was watching a Colbert show the other night with a gentleman who was talking about how we can release endorphins and release dopamine without drug stimulation. I mean, that's mm-hmm. one of the problems with opiates is that they do that for us, but they're opiates and then we become addicted to them.
Right.
And so they were giving music is another thing that makes our body release these endorphins, but so do flowers. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, when we started our show in 1999, is that correct? 2019, sorry. 2019. In 2019, when we started our show, that was our driving force, was to bring these pieces together and start to tell people about the health and wellness benefits of flowers. And it's been something that's kind of been on our radar in the US for a long time. So like, just as an example, when you go to Amsterdam, when you go to someone's house, you bring flowers.
Right. Yes.
That's the thing. And my Amsterdam friends joke, oh, you're Americans. You bring wine and help us drink half of it. And I mean, that's hysterical. But so you bring flowers. And we've always tried to teach Americans to have a more European embrace of what flowers are like and how you bring them and have them in your home. Well, we started our show and then the pandemic hit.
Yeah.
And people were unplugging from cable, but they were still watching public television. They were seeing our show. They had to go to the grocery store to buy supplies. They saw the flowers, they picked them up, and they started to experience, and there was this sudden boon mm-hmm. in flower purchases throughout the entire pandemic, bigger than we've ever seen in the history of flowers in this United States. And really, I mean, you know, the thing that was happening was people were experiencing for themselves, I can pick up this bouquet of flowers along with these eggs and bread and I can take it home and hey, you know what? I feel better.
Yeah.
We're not arguing as much in our home. And all of those things started to come together. And since then, that weekly pickup of flowers along with groceries has been extremely popular and hasn't lost track.
Oh, I love hearing that. I think that's great. And it dovetails, I think, with this resurgence in an interest in heritage crafts, too, at that particular time. I mean, like baking bread Absolutely. And, you know, things that have been with humans for, you know, hundreds of years, really.
It's so interesting because my parents, I mean, I learned through osmosis, obviously, through my father, my grandfather, my mother, my grandmother, and designers who worked at the store. But my parents wanted me to be classically trained in floral design. So they, when I was 17, sent me to Japan to study Ikenobo, which is a school of Ikebana flower design, so that I could be trained classically mm-hmm. in the art of flower design. And then they also, I mean, I've been to many schools, including one by Phil Rolota, who is he's an icon and a mentor in the flower industry. He's the one who taught me the elements and principles of floral design. And then florists have this weird thing that they do and I don't know if they still do it, but my parents sure were involved in it. My dad had two best friends and they all traded children for a year. And so what? I went to work for one. I went to go to live with this other family where I worked in the wholesale division of floristry. And I actually dyed carnations. That was my job. And then, you know, my my parents took a girl who was in a grower situation where her family grew plants and brought her into our retail establishment. And then the guy from the wholesale department went to work for the grower. So we, the three of us, traded kids for a year, and we got to learn other aspects of the flower industry.
Wow. How about that? So I want to go back to something you had said earlier about your mother. You said that your mother was a floral communicator. Can you tell me what that is and what that involves?
Okay, so in our industry, many years ago, florists would teach each other by having these events on weekends at wholesale distributors where they would gather sometimes 70, sometimes 1,200, depending upon where you were in the country, and they would be taught how to arrange. Generally, there was a panel of four or five designers and then a professional flower communicator or a commentator at that time who would tell the audience what they were seeing and explain things, because sometimes creative people don't express themselves as well. They're very good at what they're doing, but they don't know how to teach it to somebody. And so kind of like a teacher that would head the class to allow them to learn what they were doing. Now, in the flower industry, there are many designers who are also communicators. I've literally done thousands of those types of educational events in the flower industry in the U.S. Then when before the pandemic even rolled around, we started to see those were dying off. I mean, there was a lot more information being available online and stuff, so those live events didn't happen as much. Mm-hmm. And what we're noticing now, we're about 10 or 15 years into that lack of those live educational events. And hearsay and old wives' tales are taking over, and people aren't using the best methods. And a lot of people are making mistakes that I would teach people not to make because I had made them myself. You teach people about flowers one person at a time. Now, there may be 70 people in a group, but I'm going to have to connect to each of those people in an individual way to make sure they understand what I've said and how it relates to them and the mm-hmm. best way for them to utilize that information.
And individuals have different aesthetic responses to things as well. So absolutely. They will want to make different choices.
And you know, the best part about these educational events I would give is people would come up afterwards and say, okay, let me tell you my story. Perfect. Let's see how this relates to you.
Yeah.
And let's help you. And you know what? That's what I love about public television and my show, is that I get hundreds, literally hundreds of emails every week from people who are watching the show. And some of them are like, you know, hey, I have this vase and I made this arrangement in it, and what do you think of it? Or do you think I could put red roses in this vase? You know, and much of it is just someone granting them permission, correct?
Right. Yeah, of course.
At the same time, we had a lady who her husband developed cancer and she was in her home and she was feeling her whole world closing in on her, and she found our show. And she watched the show and she would tape them so that she could replay them, because that brought comfort and it brought assurance to her. And then she shared that her husband passed away, and now she has that loss, but she's replaced that loss with our show.
Right.
You know, I'm going to bring it back to you in that Bob Ross is a hero of mine. Bob Ross and Mr. Rogers have influenced and mentored my show so much because they make people feel good. And making people feel good is a rare commodity these days. And so we want to continue that work. And
it's so important nowadays, especially. And you mentioned Bob Ross, and there is actually a Bob Ross themed episode coming up in season 7, is there not? And you were here in Muncie.
I was. So, I made myself a promise the other day that I need to start laughing and having more fun and not being emotional and crying so much because I'm an emotional person. But I met Joan Kowalski, and she was at our American Public Television Fall Marketplace with Nicholas.
Nicholas who?
Nicholas Hankins. He is the new host of The Joy of Painting. He is a certified Bob Ross painter, and he's wonderful. He is so cool because when you talk to him, it's almost like talking to Bob himself. He embodies Bob Ross's work so incredibly.
Well, so much so that he's doing the new Joy of Painting. Is that correct?
Correct. The unfinished canvases. So he's taking 12 of Bob Ross's unfinished canvases and finishing them. So Joan Kowalski is the CEO of, is the president of Bob Ross Inc. Well, last year she came up to me and said, I want to give you a opportunity to come to where Bob stood in his studio that was inside that home that the Ball family had donated for his studio.
Yeah.
And have you interpret one of his paintings through flowers. And so then she said, well, you need to pick out a painting. And there is only one painting that Bob did that has flowers in it. And it was in season 26, episode 5. And it's called A Trace of Spring.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so then they set up A Trace of Spring and allowed me to bring in an arrangement and make an arrangement. And Joan met me there and she guested on the show as well. And I have to tell you that when you go to the Bob Ross Experience, it's an amazing, amazing experience because there's a place on the ground where, like, you know, where he'd beat the devil out of the brushes and it would splatter the paint. And there's like two footprints where his feet always were.
Yeah.
And so, you know, when I came in and my crew had already been there and they'd all been working with Brian Statz from Mini Trista Museum and bless Brian's heart, because he was standing there and he's like, well, Jay, I think we're all ready for you. Does everything look okay? And I was just like, oh, and I was just sobbing like a baby.
Oh, wow. It was a spiritual experience.
Right. And Brian was like, is everything okay? I was like, it's perfect. Everything is perfect. And I said, who gets to do this? Who gets to stand there where Bob stood and interpret one of his paintings through flowers? And he's like, well, you do.
Yep. That's
set up is that you get to do this. And it was just so, I mean, that's the pinnacle of my career. I mean, right now, that's the pinnacle of my career is that, you know, I got to stand where Bob stood and I got to interpret something that Bob created. It's mind blowing. It's mind blowing.
Well, and I am sure that is going to come through in the episode, and I just cannot wait to see it. And additionally, Jay, another one of the episodes in season 7 prominently features ball jars. Is that true?
It's true. It was such a great opportunity because, you know, the Bob Ross Experience is at the Mini Trista Museum and Gardens, and the Mini Trista Museum is all about ball jars. And that's just one of my favorite things is a canning jar is such a great vessel for flowers. And that episode, we visited with Tanya there,
Tanya Saeed. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Tanya Saeed. And she told us about all the different types that are there. And they even brought out parts of their heritage collection for us to show off. One of the most valuable and rarest mason jar that is yellow.
Oh, wow. And Jay, what a joy it's been to talk with you today. It's been such a pleasure to learn about your life and your passion for flowers. And again, to share an avenue of art and artistic expression that maybe our viewers don't think about too much.
And my pleasure.
We can't wait until you join us again in Muncie for maybe more Bob Ross stuff.
Absolutely. I can't wait. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Jay.
We've been listening to our interview with Jay Schwanke, florist and host of PBS's Life in Bloom.
You can see the episode he filmed at Minnetrista in Muncie this Saturday, April 19th at 9 a.m. on Ball State PBS.
It's time for What Are You Working On? This week, we're listening back to interviews that convince us it's actually springtime outside.
Oh, please.
Yes. So we thought we'd revisit the stunning ecosystem paintings of artist Anne Maddox. She is an artist, educator, writer, and wildlife advocate, British-born, and currently resides in Marion. Welcome, Anne. It's nice to have you here with us today.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Excellent. We would like to ask you, what are you working on?
Well, I am finishing up the last of a series of six ecosystem paintings. I've been working on them for over 15 years now, and this will be my last. They're very time-consuming.
Can you explain to us what an ecosystem painting is?
Okay, it's like a little slice of time and space that shows the interconnectedness of both nature and the animals or critters, insects that inhabit that space. And I restrict it to a time period, so I'm not going from month to month.
Okay, so you say it's a slice of time and space. So during a certain season or?
Well, in summertime is when you get all of the flowers that grow on the roadsides. The woodland is more of the spring flowers before the trees foliate, and so they get maximum sunshine. But in the summer, you'll get all the roadside and meadow flowers with all the accompanying critters that inhabit that little space and time.
Oh, wonderful. I read that a few years ago you received the Robert Cooper Audubon Society Award for Education Through Art, and they're a chapter of East Central Indiana. And this year you were the recipient of the Hoosier Women Artists Award. And I wanted to talk to you about the award you got for Ecosystem One. And actually, you've brought Ecosystem One into the studio today, and myself and Luke are amazed. Your work is just so intricate. How would you term your work, your style?
Well, it's realism, obviously. I want people to be able to recognize what they're looking at. And then I have a guide that goes with each painting that gives you the names of all of the plants and insects and birds in the picture.
Yeah, it looks like a map that you could put up next to the work. And without it, you might miss some things because it's so packed with beautiful things. Can you talk a little bit about the colors you utilize?
Well, it's the colors I find in nature. Some of them are very hard to duplicate because the pigments don't always line up with the actual flower. So some things are easier to paint than others. But I try to be as true as I can so that people can recognize it and be able to see it in the wild and know what it is. But I was painting flowers initially. I was teaching in the Bahamas and discovered that there was no local book for other than experts that could identify the flowers. So I figured it couldn't be too hard to just go ahead, and I started painting the flowers that I found and then got help identifying them.
What medium do you use typically to create them?
These are all done in watercolors.
The whole series is watercolors.
Mm-hmm. And I work from the actual plant. I don't use photographs. And there's nowhere you can go and just take a snapshot of what I've got and say that this is the ecosystem, because I go back constantly to the area or similar areas and then add the birds or other critters that I have seen, but not necessarily all at the same time, at the same place. So I work piecemeal and build it up like a jigsaw puzzle.
Well, you said that you're working towards the end of this series after 15 years on it, which is amazing.
They take the minimum of 2 years apiece.
Wow. That's an incredible commitment. I wanted to know what's next for you in your artistic journey.
Well, what I'm doing is moving out of having to do sort of shows and festivals and things. I want to just concentrate on going out as a speaker. Mm. So I'm taking, using my art to illustrate my message. So it's education through art. So I'm finally, since I also trained as a teacher, I'm bringing all my skills and loves together, art, nature, and teaching.
Oh, that's beautiful, right? When everything you love can coalesce. How do you utilize your art in teaching?
Well, what I'm trying to tell people I'm trying to open their eyes to understand what is happening in nature, and that is that nature is interconnected in so many ways that we're still learning about, that we're talking about relationships, and we can't pick and choose what we want to save or nurture or whatever. We have to have the whole picture, because when you start missing out certain building blocks, the whole thing collapses, because everything in nature eats and is eaten by something else. So it's the birds rely on the caterpillars. If there aren't enough caterpillars to satisfy the needs of the birds, then the caterpillars won't be around to turn into butterflies. So that it's that balance in nature that needs to be maintained. And we are very uneducated, generally speaking, about how all this works together.
Well, that's a wonderful endeavor. I do think that a lot of people are unaware of the synergy that nature has.
Oh, absolutely. So what I'm trying to do is to encourage people to create habitats in their gardens or yards, because they have control over that area, whereas out in nature, what the farmers don't get, real estate does, all the roadsides are mowed on a regular basis.
Is that what your Wild About Marion Facebook page is?
Yes, it is. And what I'm finding is that there are other communities that have started something similar, but they've given it a different name. So it's becoming quite a sort of movement to encourage city dwellers to take care of nature by offering them a space that they can control.
Well, can you tell us where we can find your art?
Well, I have a Facebook art page. So that's Ann Maddox, Fine Artist. And then I have a Flickr page. I've tried for a website a couple of times, but you're going to outlay quite a lot of money just trying to get something that's functional. It doesn't always translate into getting sales online, unfortunately.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Anne.
Thank you.
And it was a pleasure talking with you.
Well, I appreciate that. Thank you.
You're listening to Pop of Culture. I'm Luke Jones. The arts calendar is my responsibility this week, so let's get into it. It's the last indoor farmers market of the season at Minnetrista Museum and Gardens this Saturday, April 19th from 9 a.m. to noon. Avoid the forecasted April showers and find handcrafted goods, fresh meats, treats, and more from the safety of the indoors. Address and more information are at minnetrista.net. In downtown Muncie, also Saturday, April 19th, the Muncie Children's Museum is open to the public. Explore the world of STEM with Discovery Park, splash safely at the White River Water Table, dress up like a conductor and follow model trains through a city that looks a lot like Muncie, climb the ant wall, and much more. I'm also realizing now that's probably what the children should be doing, but honestly, I think a water table sounds pretty soothing right now. Next up, the Muncie Children's Museum, Saturday, April 19th, from 10 to 5. More at MuncieMuseum.com. If karaoke night is your thing, join the interactive Dueling Pianos this Thursday, April 24th at 7:30 in Poos Hall. Two talented pianists will tickle the ivories on grand pianos, but they'll need your help with requests, sing-alongs, and dancing. So if it's still rock and roll to you, come just the way you are to join the piano man or men or women through the long night. Or if you're not a Billy Joel fan, you can be Benny or the Jets and sing your song, whether you're into crocodile rock or sad songs that say so much. And if you're not a Billy Joel or an Elton John fan, I cannot help you. All the information is at bsu.edu/Pruis. That's P-R-U-I-S. Taylor University presents Guys and Dolls, a musical fable of Broadway. Often hailed as the greatest musical ever written, the show follows charming gambler Skye Masterson and principal admission worker Sarah Brown, among others, as the stakes are raised in love and luck. Get whisked to the big city with dazzling dance numbers and sharp wit. The show opens Friday, April 25th, and runs through May 4th at Taylor University's Mitchell Theater, located in Upland, Indiana. More showtimes are at taylor.edu, or you can call their box office at 765-998-5289. If you have a dazzling number to add to our arts calendar, find us online at indianapublicradio.org/contact and then select from the drop-down menu, Pop of Culture. Pop of Culture on IPR is made possible in part by Psi Iota Xi. Additional support comes from the Indiana Arts Commission, the Community Foundation of Randolph County, the National Endowment for the Arts, and sustaining members of IPR. You can support local programming today at indianapublicradio.org.
And that's our show. Our executive producer is Angie Rapp, and our regular producer is Luke Jones, who would not mind seeing less rain and more life in bloom. Our show was hosted by me, Kara Duquette.
And me, Jen Blackmer. Pop of Culture is a production of IPR on the campus of Ball State University.